Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And in today's podcast, I'm going to look at British student radicalism in 1968 and thereafter, and look at the shortcomings of the British left-wing alternative society counterculture that emerged compared to their European and American counterparts. By 1968, two trends had brought about a radicalisation on university campuses from Mexico to Boston in America, to Paris, to the Sorbonne, to German campuses. We've talked a lot in this podcast about West German students in 1968, and also to Great Britain. And it was really the demographic explosion of the post-war era. The baby boom had finally come of age in the mid to late 1960s, and also the impact of the Vietnam War. A third effect had been the end of, or the beginnings of the end of, the great post-war boom. By the late 1960s in Britain, towards the end of Harold Wilson's government, the post-war boom is beginning to really drift towards recession, creeping unemployment, which really manifests itself more in the early 70s, but creeping inflation and trade union unrest, industrial unrest, declining productivity and relative economic decline that no British government seems to be able to arrest. These all create the kind of the context for increased radicalism. And the change in thinking among many students in Great Britain, but also across the Western world during the 1960s, on issues such as race, gender, class, sexuality, environmentalism, was kind of reflective of intellectual changes in the Western world during the post-war or era. So the generation who protested in 1968 in Britain looked to France, where the country was brought almost to the point of revolution in 1968, and saw that as a kind of a powerful example. But in Britain, nothing quite as dramatic actually happens, which might tell you something generally about the difference between Britain and France in the normal conditions. The idea of there being an alternative society or a counterculture had its roots really in the 1950s. And many of the more significant figures in this 1950s counterculture had been at Oxford and Cambridge, or at the new art colleges that had emerged in the post-war era. It was inspired by French existentialism, jazz music, by the beat poets of the American beat poets of the 1950s, and was often a reaction against things such as British National Service and the generally kind of small-minded post-war conservatism that was satirised by people such as the Beyond the Fringe performers. That was the week that was Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, Jonathan Miller, and that generation who saw Britain and really England as a small, closed, hypocritical and repressed society, and the events such as the Profumo scandal and the various sex scandals surrounding British spies and diplomats abroad highlighted the double standards and hypocrisy of British society. And this was the first generation of the kind of the counterculture. A big part of that was the revival of or the establishment of CND and the marches to Aldermaston nuclear research establishment. Much of this was London centric. Some of it was dotted around the country. There were parts of Leeds and Sheffield, Manchester, and the rest of the northwest, where elements of a kind of a counterculture existed, but it was fairly thin on the ground, and in most instances and at most times, countercultural movements tend to attract little more than a smattering of support. They can be very loud and very lively, but as far as encapsulating the majority of the population in any given age, that's particularly rare. And as Dominic Sandbrook points out in his brilliant book on Britain 64-70, White Heat, this was really the preserve of the upper middle classes, because they had the time and the money to be able to engage in such lofty pursuits, and this is very often the case. The 1960s, as remembered by most people in Great Britain, was not a time of protesting against the Vietnam War, and the 1950s, as remembered by most people in Great Britain, was not a time of protesting against Suez particularly. These things took place, but they were engaged in by a minority of people. An indicator as to the size, scope and popularity of Britain's counterculture came on the 11th of June 1965 at the Royal Albert Hall International Festival of Poetry. And it was here that Allen Ginsberg had visited from America, Ginsberg, of course, being the leading light of the beat poets and a countercultural figure in his own right, kind of holding court in and around the world of the Grateful Dead in San Francisco by this point. And he had come to Britain to take part with poets from all over the world. At this point, probably the most famous and popular poet in Great Britain was John Betjeman, who wrote long paeans to the wonders of train commuting in Metroland from London to Aylesbury, and the horrors of Slough, industrial estate town on the M4. A place I have lived and can attest to its everything that Betjeman said was true. The poetry was normally a kind of a fairly minority interest in Britain, but Ginsberg seemed to draw an enormous crowd on that particular day, of thousands of people coming to listen to him. The popular appeal of Allen Ginsberg's poetry in Britain in the 1960s, I would imagine, is incredibly slim. That's probably it still is now. But still, people not in their dozens or in their hundreds, but in their thousands, came to listen to him and to listen to his words and lyrics on the possibility of countercultural thought. There is a great deal of attention paid to the International Poetry Festival in 1965 because it seems to have been one of these moments in cultural history where people suddenly became aware that they weren't alone. And this is normally, in any kind of cultural movement, particularly popular cultural movements, a moment where kind of things become galvanized, where it's sort of like a little lightning rod for cultural change. The attendance was enormous by the standards of normal poetry readings, but probably smaller than a Saturday football match. And it still meant very little normally to most people in Britain whose interests were things such as football and pop music and their hopefully continuing rising living standards. The listeners to Ginsberg were people who would have been aware of the growing art house happenings in and around London, where theatre, music, art and film, surrealism and existentialism all merged to create events that were often fueled by the beginnings of an appetite for things like LSD, and were largely incomprehensible and impenetrable to those who were uneducated in them or disinterested in them. Decried, perhaps rightly by some, as impenetrable, pretentious, and celebrations of the avant-garde for its own sake, where those who were educated at art school level in things like Dada and Surrealism and Expressionism, abstract Expressionism, could be rather self-congratulatory towards one another. These became synonymous or symbolised the kind of the left field bohemianism of London in the 1960s, and have often been parodied in a variety of ways. Often, art house happenings were about trying to gain a reaction from the Lord Chamberlain, who since Tudor times and up until 1968 had been responsible for theatrical censorship and again was an exemplar from the Lady Chatterley trial onwards of the sort of like the kind of the petty repressiveness of mid-50s British society.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A range of radical bookshops, normally in London, of art and theatre establishments, countercultural educational establishments, such as the Notting Hill Free School, and other left-of-field theatre groups emerged. Often these had varying degrees of success, and often they were less about education and art and more about means of throwing off the conformity of middle-class life, and obviously engaging in drugs and sex and that sort of thing. And again, it seems very much like the pursuits of people with the income to sustain that kind of activity. Working class people were generally excluded from much of this fun because of the pressures of work and low pay. On the fringes of many of these bookshops and boutiques and schools were some quite famous figures: Paul McCartney and Marian Faithfull, and occasionally members of the Rolling Stones, would patronise them. Filmmakers like Michelangelo Antonioni and the various people in and around groups such as Pink Floyd would appear and be seen and make these places terrifically fashionable. Very often commercial pressures and the problems of petty theft from the shop and a lack of business experience and the kind of the hard-headed business decisions that actually require these places to survive often drove them underground. But the energy that poured into much of this culture was the campaign against the Vietnam War, which saw people come together in shared spaces such as radical bookshops and meeting places, events, and share ideas and exist within a common culture which had previously been politicised only to the extent that it rejected the staid conventions of bourgeoisie. But the Vietnam War gave it a cause, and it gave it a more politicised, anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist, and to some extent Marxist definition. The periodical of the era was the International Times, or the IT, which was established in October 1966, at about which time the alternative society in London began to find Vietnam as its rallying call. There had been a kind of a long tradition of radical publications long before this, dating back, you know, deep into the 19th century. But this was something of a kind of a key moment in the 1960s avant-garde community, because it was able to connect with a student audience and a widespread and growing audience at that. it had to rely on advertising, but its founders were able to attract the kind of advertisers that would be attractive to that audience, so record fashion companies and these sorts of advertisers who existed within this kind of countercultural milieu. The launch party attracted important figures such as Paul McCartney again, and it was combined with an art house music happening with live music from Pink Floyd and Soft Machine. And once again, like the Poetry Festival, this had been a key moment in the establishment of the counterculture in London in the 1960s. One account put it, all these little groups from all over London were massing together. This it thing, they were actually rubbing up against each other, sharing joints, talking frantically about about turning on the world. Everyone had made plans of various kinds, and they all babbled away furiously about either electrifying the skies so that messages of peace and love could be beamed off the clouds, or turning European universities into a vast library of worthwhile information, and so on. It all seemed like a jolly good fun and a good idea at the time. So make of that what you will. But the magazine, the IT, eventually folded in 1973. It didn't have anywhere near the longevity and the success of its American counterparts, perhaps because of the size of its audience compared to the US. By 1968, the circulation was at least 40,000 every fortnight, which is quite significant. But this was its peak. It went into decline after that, and then the editors were forced out in 1969 by 1968 by other contributors. And they were then kicked out the following year. And office politics saw the magazine descend into anarchy, and the business strategy was non-existent. And, unfortunately for all revolutionaries around the world, it comes to a simple, harsh reality that publications require management and structure like pretty much everything else. By 1973, as I said, it had gone underground, but there had been a range of other magazines that had far greater impact. One particular one, there's perhaps not time to talk about it now, was Black Dwarf, which spawned the careers of both Tariq Ali and Sheila Rowbottom. John Peel, the DJ, who existed in this on the fringes of this world, made the point that everything about it was terribly small and very, very localised. Everybody knew each other, and they existed in their own radical echo chamber. And so there was very little chance of it really kind of going beyond all that. One key reason for the development of the new feminism of the 1970s was the misogyny and sexism that existed within the counterculture of the British alternative society. Sheila Rowbottom, who worked for the magazine Black Dwarf, who became the central figure of 1970s British feminism, Marxist feminism, said that basically the left and the counterculture in the 1960s was a man's game, that women were treated such as sex objects, tea makers, secretaries, but as far as having equivalents in revolutionary thought and policy and activism, they were sidelined and ignored. And what Sheila Rowbottom pointed out was that simply because men follow the dictates of Karl Marx or Antonio Gramsci or whoever else, it doesn't necessarily follow that they will adopt feminist ideas, and that on the left there was sexism just as much as in any other political field. Dominic Sambuk writes, "Girls," said one female art student, "were expected to sit quietly in the corner, rolling joints, nodding your head. You were really there for fucks and domesticity." Social elitism on the left and in the counterculture of the 1960s was also a key factor in excluding ordinary people. There was no doubt a great deal of intellectual snobbery, but the upper middle classes who had embraced the counterculture managed to build their own barriers to exclusion to working class people. So the 60s New Left had very little to do with traditional working class struggle. The key difference between the American counterculture and the British one was that the defining crisis in American history that brought about the New Left in America was obviously the Vietnam War. The defining crisis in British history that brought about the New Left happened a decade earlier in the guise of the Soviet destruction of Hungarian democracy. This had an impact on the British left, because the British left up until that point had been coalesced around the Communist Party of Great Britain that had sympathies, overt sympathies towards Stalin and Stalinism. And it was this atrocity, international outrage, that ended the claim that the Soviet Union had to any kind of progressive politics, and it saw the mass exodus of the left from the Communist Party of Great Britain, and effectively saw the Communist Party's marginalisation on the left, and the search for new forms of kind of radicalism and new radical organisations began in the late 50s, early 60s. And when the Vietnam War reached the height of its ferocity and the protests against it around the world reached their climax, new critiques on the left, the New Left as it was referred to, of both the Soviet Union and the USA, and a broader critique of power itself were increasingly popular. Anyway, I'm going to finish there. I hope you found that useful and interesting, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. If you can pop by our Patreon page to fund us, that would be very helpful, and look forward to speaking with you again soon. All the best. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.